Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Top 100 Project with Ryan and Bev Ellis. If you're a new listener, we invite you to check out our introductory podcast in which we discuss the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 lists of the greatest American films of all time. Before you go any further, be warned, what you're about to hear is riddled with spoilers. We suggest you watch the movie before listening to this podcast.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hello, everybody. It's Bev and Ryan, and Fox is with us, and you'll probably hear him on this one. We're going to start this podcast by answering trivia from last week's podcast. The Not 100 Project's debut was Die Hard, and I ended it by asking a harder question than the other three that we answered within the podcast. Here it is. Which of the five Die Hard movies had three actors in the cast who were nominated for Academy Awards and other films, one of whom even won? And name those actors. Bev, one more shot at it.
Oh, give me a break.
Okay. Here they are. It was Die Hard with a Vengeance, the third one.
Okay.
The actors were Jeremy Irons, who won the Oscar for Reversal of Fortune.
Okay. Sam Jackson.
Sam Jackson for Pulp Fiction, nominated the year before Die Hard with a Vengeance. And the other one is a little more obscure. The third one is Graham Greene, who's in the movie as one of the cops. He was nominated.
Is he really?
He was nominated for Dances with Wolves
as best supporting actor. Canadians all know who Graham Greene is because he's Canadian and he got nominated for an Oscar.
So there it is. That's the answer. And if somebody got that already, kudos to you. And if you are kicking yourself now, then kudos to me. So, here we go. The Top 100 Project's 21st movie is The Wizard of Oz. I hope you've heard of it. This is the first film we've reviewed that cracked the top 10. Oz was sixth on AFI's 1998 Top 100 list, sitting between Lawrence of Arabia and The Graduate, but dropped down a few spots in 2007, ranking 10th between Vertigo and City Lights. After a premiere in mid-August of 1939, The Wizard of Oz was unleashed to the public by MGM on August 25th, 1939. That's one day shy of 74 years ago. And to put that into perspective, this movie came out when Dustin Hoffman and Jack Nicholson were only 2 years old. Nicholson probably still had three girlfriends. Surprisingly, Oz was not a massive hit at first, but its many re-releases made a mint. So here's Bev with the skinny.
Dude, just The Wizard of Oz, everybody knows this movie.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. Now, the movie in a nutshell. Here we go. Landmark moment in the history of the movie in a nutshell, which to many of you is not a common thing. I've been doing it for many months now, and I will defer to the man who inspired my nutshell idea, Rick Polito of the Marin Independent Journal. His synopsis of The Wizard of Oz was, transported to a surreal landscape, a young girl kills the first person she meets, and then teams up with three strangers to kill again. So kudos to Rick for inspiring me last fall to come up with similar movie synopses, although I don't think I'll ever top that one.
Oh no, that is pure genius.
I've read that so many times to people, they always laugh, and I've tried to equal it or top it. I'm going to keep on trying without succeeding.
Funny because it's so true. Mm-hmm. The movie really is about a young girl who's like become an unwitting assassin.
Well, they're trying to get her broomstick, although in the book I believe they're trying to kill her, and that's what the wizard wants.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, they do end up killing her, whether they mean to or not.
How will we ever eliminate our rivals?
And take her main source of power. Yes. Let's ask her for it.
or convince a young girl to do it for us.
Okay, then, Wizard of Oz. This was not the first time you've seen this, but you did not recall having really seen it before. Now you've seen it all the way through. I've seen it probably a dozen times. What did you think?
Yeah, I saw it when I was younger, but too young to really remember it properly. And then for whatever reason, I just never saw it again. But of course, it's The Wizard of Oz. It's so ubiquitous in culture that it's impossible not to know about it. But it really never captured my imagination as a kid. I was never really that crazy about it. So watching it now as an adult without those kind of fond childhood memories to
enhance it.
Yeah, I guess you could say enhance it. Without the feeling of nostalgia. Yeah, exactly. I think a lot of people watch this movie. You know, there is science behind this. The human brain actually does experience, let's say, works of art, works of media, culture. The brain experiences these things differently when you're younger. It is actually more impactful to a younger brain than it is to an older person, which is part of the reason why those things that you love when you were a kid, you just never stop loving. They always really hold this special place in your heart. And I think that's probably part of what's behind the popularity of this film, because the Library of Congress called it the most watched motion picture in history. and at least partially thanks to its annual tradition of airing it on TV the second Sunday of every December that lasted for decades. And families made it a tradition to watch it, and people watched it over and over again. And I think that when you have something that everybody experienced for the first time when they were a kid, you're always going to have this fondness for it that you probably wouldn't have if you see it as an adult. So I watched it and I understand that, like, there's no arguing that it's a great film. It's absolutely a great film. It doesn't win me over, I think, the way it wins other people over. I actually went to the trouble of having a very unscientific poll of my friends ask what they thought of it, and they all kind of said the same thing. You know, I loved it when I was a kid, and I haven't watched it in a long time, but I still love it. Like, it's still something that I have fond memories of, and they love the associations of this movie.
I'd be curious if they did see it, if they felt the way that you do now.
Well, you tell me. Did you love this movie as a kid?
I've surprised myself in the number of times I've said on these podcasts that a movie isn't quite as effective for me as it used to be, the comedies especially. When we watched Duck Soup, you didn't like the movie much at all because you didn't laugh. I didn't laugh as much as I had before.
Mm-hmm.
I was never a gigantic fan, but I was a fan. And that may be true of other films too. The general, maybe not quite as strong as it used to be. And even Snow White, maybe, wasn't quite as strong for me as it used to be. And these two films can be linked in many ways. Snow White and Wizard of Oz, we'll probably talk about that in a moment or two. I think Oz has maintained it. It doesn't charm me as much as it did. I don't remember seeing it as a kid, though, come to think of it.
Oh, really?
Hey, I don't know if I've ever said this on this podcast before, but I was not a big movie fan until I was about, I don't know, 19 years old, 19 or 20 years old. I was a sports guy, and I don't think I saw more than a dozen movies in the theater until about the mid-90s.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember when I saw Oz for the first time, but I'm pretty sure it wasn't until around then. I've only ever seen it in home video. But yeah, it's maintained for me. I still like it a lot.
What's its appeal for you?
Because I didn't see it as a kid, I can't make that comparison that you just made a minute ago. I don't know. I think it's a... When a movie is great, and that's such a broad word, but when a movie is considered great, when I think of a movie as great, I can't necessarily answer the question of why I like it so much.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly like the songs. As much as I ripped on Swing Time... And the musical, we went into a whole tangent about musicals and Swing Time. The songs in this and the songs in Singing in the Rain and the songs in South Park, the movie, and some of the other musicals, that's a strange threesome, I know.
Oh my God, it's so funny you mentioned that I've had Kyle's mom as a bitch in my head for like the past month. You've heard me singing it.
I have. I've sung it too.
Mm.
But those kinds of musicals, I think, are terrific. We've got so many more we're going to see. We've seen a few already. This one works as a musical. The songs are terrific. I love the point in the AFI special, the 1988 special, when Richard Dreyfuss talks about Oz, and he says, if you go to a mortuary at 3 a.m, and the two guys are sitting there watching this movie, is when it's Follow the Yellow Brick Road. When that song plays, I have been known to bounce in my chair, because it's a really catchy song. Although, what did you say when that moment happened in the film?
So when I was a kid, I always remembered, like, a very few things about my impression of this movie as a kid, and they were all things that bothered me about it. And one of them was that when Dorothy finally takes their instructions and starts following the Yellow Brick Road, does she just, like, see where it leads and, like,
take a shortcut?
No, she starts in the middle of that spiral. And for some reason in my, like, highly analytical 5-year-old brain, it bothered me so much. See, I've always been this way. It bothered me so much that she would foolishly start in the middle of that spiral when clearly she can see that she's wasting her time, and those shoes don't look comfortable. She has a long way to walk.
That backdrop is only about 50 feet away.
That's true. If she had taken one more step, she would have Truman showed right into, like, the backdrop.
One thing about those backdrops, incidentally, when she's in Oz, I kind of like, is that it's a fever dream. It's an imagination sequence. The whole thing is, as we know, it's a dream. So anything that looks fake can be excused for that reason.
And who cares? The sets are so beautiful. They're just incredible. Like, every detail of it. I was thinking when we were watching the movie, one thing that's wonderful about it is you can tell this is a production that did not have to... Nobody said no to these people. When they were like, so we're going to hire 100 little people and dress them up in elaborate costumes. Some of them won't even really get much screen time at all.
And makeup.
And, oh, you know, I think I want a human-sized nest. And there's going to be 5 munchkins in the nest. And they're all going to be wearing elaborate costumes. And it's going to get a grand total of 2 seconds of screen time. And they got it. They got it. I love watching that. I mean, the decadence of this movie is just so delicious. It's really... And they really nailed it. You know, they really took advantage of that bottomless budget that they had.
And if they made the movie now, they'd have 3 times as many munchkins, and they would all, or mostly, be digital.
Oh, yeah. Look at the remake of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, They only had one Oompa Loompa. And it was, oh, what's his
Deep
name?
Deep Roy.
And he was great, but it was, in a way, I think a lot of people agree with us, and a lot of people have been criticizing this lately. Like, digital is kind of just less magical.
It's showing off.
It just doesn't work as well either. There's something about it. Everybody knows what they're looking at is fake. No matter how good it gets, as soon as you know you're looking at something digital, it's just, I don't know, it spoils it just a little bit. But Wizard of Oz was just, I mean, every shot is breathtaking. The Blu-ray looks absolutely magnificent. The print is great. And, you know, that really iconic shot when she steps from the sepia house and she opens the door and she enters the Munchkin Land. It is still truly breathtaking.
Okay, we didn't start off by saying the thing that we talked about a few hours ago. How do we review Wizard of Oz?
Oh, God.
And there will be many other movies on this project with the same thought about. We've already done enough of the reviewing. We have a lot more to go. But one thing we can do instead of simply reviewing and rehashing things that people know are talking about trivia moments that they may know, but I'm not sure that they would. One of those would be in that shot when Dorothy comes out of the house. It's crashing Oz. Goes from sepia to Oz being the background. You've got both of them on the screen at the same time, the color and the sepia tone. The way they did that, it's a double for Dorothy wearing a black and white dress, and they sepia toned it in such a way. She walks back. The camera stays still. She walks out of the shot. And then Judy Garland, hey, first time we mentioned the star of the movie, Judy Garland walks into the shot with Toto in full color. And so it's always been a thing that maybe you don't even notice it, but there you go. That's how they technically did something that was so great, too.
I noticed it when we were watching the movie, and then I read later how they did it, but I remember as we were watching it, I was like, oh, I kind of wanted to watch it again to just examine it and think about how maybe they did pull that off. And they painted the inside of the house sepia tone. They put her in a sepia tone gingham dress that was identical to Dorothy's, but different color.
And the key is having the body double go off screen.
Yeah. It's so brief, you really don't notice it. It's so well done.
That would be so easy to do today digitally. That'd be simple. They do color grading all the time on every movie now, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Certainly just about every movie. But yeah, there you go. There's a poor man's process that worked so
but
well.
But at the time, in 1939, when the movie came out, the visual effects were actually revolutionary. It would have been an event film for people to go see for the spectacle of it.
And the irony was, it was an okay success at best.
Yeah, the re-releases, like you said, made up for it, and the TV syndication.
And it's just built in fame as it's gone on.
There's a great quote I found from Ray Bolger, the actor who played the Scarecrow. When somebody asked him if he ever received royalties for all the TV airings of the movie, he famously responded, "No, just immortality. I'll settle for that."
You got it.
Oh, yeah. This movie is beyond the movie. Like, it is so... And, of course, the book deserves credit as well, but it is so ubiquitous in culture, in American culture. It's considered a true American fairy tale. It's really hard to separate the movie from the legacy of the movie.
You said the book. Let's talk about the author. L. Frank Baum wrote it. It was actually The Wonderful Wizard of Oz as a book. And then Disney, good old Walt, wanted to make this movie, or a movie of Wizard of Oz, a follow-up to Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. But MGM already owned the rights. And ironically, this movie was made in a response to Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs.
It's Snow White and the 700 Dwarfs.
That's a good point. It is a very similar story structure in many ways. There's no doubt about it, yeah. And many other movies have had a similar story structure for that matter.
It's The Little Girl Lost. I read a cool thing about Baum. Apparently his mother was a famous suffragette, a contemporary of Susan B. Anthony. And her influence has been credited with him writing what's considered to be a rather feminist book, because if you think about it, only the women in this movie are powerful. The wizard pretends to have power, but he is faking it. The people with true power are all women. And it's a heroine who, in the book, apparently she's far more the protector of her three friends than she is in the movie. She turned into a damsel in distress. But yeah, apparently he was a feminist.
Well, yeah, the two villains, and I say two because the Wicked Witch of the East, who doesn't really have a part in the movie, but she's supposed to have been somebody who was terrorizing the Munchkins.
So obviously.
She's a villain to them.
You've never seen people so morbidly celebrate the death of a human being as you do the Munchkins.
Ding dong, the witch is dead.
Wow.
Yeah, this movie does glorify death, especially witch death.
It's really, considering it's a kid's movie, it is incredibly morbid.
They sing the ding dong song when the Wicked Witch of the West dies later, but it's the castle guards. They cut it for time.
Yeah.
But that song played when both witches died. I'd like to know what the Wicked Witch of the East was doing so that a house would fall on her.
No, standing in there.
How oblivious do you have to be not to notice a house coming out of the sky and falling and crushing you? Maybe she was too stupid to live. I mean, still, Glinda shouldn't have stolen her shoes. They should have gone to family.
I know. The Wicked Witch of the West was actually entitled to those shoes. She's by all
They were
accounts.
A legacy.
Yeah, she is the next of kin. And Porter, okay, so here you say there's these two villains, but isn't Glinda a villain? Now, I'm not the first. This is not a unique idea that I came with on my own. There are, of course, tons of theories and analyses of this movie and the book, but one that I think really captures a lot of people's imagination is the notion that Glinda is the true villain of the movie. If you think about it, poor innocent Dorothy is merely in the house. Like, she had nothing to do with the house landing on the Wicked Witch of the East. And the Wicked Witch of the West didn't have to know Dorothy had anything to do with it. And Glinda put the shoes on Dorothy and put them on her in such a way that you would have to murder Dorothy to get the shoes off of her feet, therefore making her the target of the Wicked Witch of the West.
One thing about that, the Wicked Witch of the West does say that the spell would be ruined if she just murdered her, or just stabbed her in the face and took them off of her. That's where the line comes, these things must be done delicately.
Oh, so maybe that's why she sets the weird, elaborate James Bond villain timer at the end.
I guess so, yes.
Is that, like, that's how long it takes to prepare the shoe spell? They don't really make that very clear. That's, like, a really silly, strange
just buying time for the heroes to save her life.
So after Glinda forces these shoes onto Dorothy's unwitting feet, she then bald-face lies to her and tells her that the wizard is the only one that can help her, which is false on two accounts, that the wizard can't actually help her. Surely Glinda knows that. And she doesn't need the wizard. She could go home right now. She has the power to go home because she has the shoes on her feet.
But she must have the experience first.
Glinda is like the Kaiser Sose of Oz. Dorothy is this unwitting pawn in the power dynamics of this foreign land's warring leaders. Poor Dorothy.
All she wants to do is go home.
She just wants to go home. And why would she want to go home? Oz is awesome.
Oz is awesome. And that's a point that's made so well by John Waters on the documentary.
Yeah.
Well, why do you want to go home so badly? And Oz is way better than Kansas.
Stick
Kansas
around for a little while. Enjoy it.
Everything was beautiful. And all I could say to everybody was, I want to go home.
To stupid Kansas.
Well, the movie teaches us that we should have a surreal experience fraught with peril and unforgettable experiences and then swiftly race home to live with non-immediate family. And their employees. Let's not forget them. It's like Oz is a stand-in for Hollywood while Kansas is a stand-in for Kansas.
I don't know. Maybe we're all selling Kansas short. Maybe Kansas is way better than everybody thinks it is.
It could be. I've been complaining for years about how Hollywood lectures the public that Joe Lunchpail needs to spend more time with the family, which is remarkably ironic coming from people who work 16 hours a day and notoriously have trouble keeping relationships intact.
I know. That's true. But it's what sells.
Okay, so last week's podcast, Die Hard, the Not 100 Project's debut, introduced something which we'd never done before, and that was trivia questions. I hope people enjoyed those. We had three during it. We had a bonus. Wizard of Oz will continue that tradition, as I think everything will from this point on, as long as I can think of some decent ones. These ones aren't quite as difficult, and maybe they're fairly easy, quite honestly. But let's give this a shot. We'll do three again. So here you go, Bev.
All right.
Trivia question number one. What is Dorothy's aunt's full first name?
It's Annie M.
Full first name.
Annie M. Obvious.
Full first name.
Annie M. Gale?
Henry Gale. Uncle Henry says it. Emily.
Emily Gale. Annie M. Gale.
All right, so if we're going to talk about Annie M., let's talk about the cast in general. Not a lot of huge stars before or after this, even though they're pretty famous names. Judy Garland's clearly the most famous actress to come out of it, or even going into it. She was already a pretty big name as a very young girl. I think she was 17 when this movie was released.
And she's playing... Isn't she? How old is Dorothy supposed to be?
Oh, younger than that, I
think. Yeah.
They were talking about it being Shirley Temple.
Yeah,
originally,
that's right.
And she, of course, was still a very young girl. But the other actors, Frank Morgan playing all the many characters,
including
the Wizard in particular, and Ray Bolger, you mentioned, playing the Scarecrow, Burt Lars, the Cowardly Lion, Jack Haley as the Tin Man, Margaret Hamilton, who's so great as the Wicked Witch of the West, and the second bananas, all those second bananas, Bolger, Haley, Lar, Morgan, Hamilton, remained supporting actors in other films in the years that followed Oz. So mostly the film didn't really breed stars. Garland also did Meet Me in St. Louis and A Star is Born, which of course are huge titles and big successes for her. Other supporting cast members included Adriana Casalotti, who has a tiny cameo as a singing voiceover, and she was the actress who did the voice for Snow White.
Yeah.
Which means that Miss Casalotti has more AFI films than Spencer Tracy, Paul Newman, Or Judy Garland.
Because she said one line off screen. Yeah.
And also an actor who was not in the film, but was supposed to be, was Buddy Ebsen. This is a pretty famous story. Jed Clampett himself, from the Beverly Hillbillies, was initially supposed to play the Scarecrow, but Ray Bolger got the producers to recast it because Bolger just wanted to play the character so badly. And then Ebsen was recast as the Tin Man, but then he had a horrendous reaction to his makeup, so he had to be in the hospital for a while. It apparently nearly killed him.
Yeah, he was in an iron lung.
And then Jack Haley took over the role, and Ebsen just, that was it, he was out, the part was gone.
They had to quietly replace the way they did the makeup. It was that the aluminum in his makeup got into his lungs. Mm-hmm. He wasn't the only actor that was injured on set. Margaret Hamilton, who played the Wicked Witch of the West, when she is initially in Munchkinland, and as she disappears, famously with the big red smoke, and the plumes of smoke, and the flames that she disappears into, there were several takes done. The first one went smoothly. She was elevated out of the shot through like a trap door. And the second one didn't time out. She's wearing all the grease makeup, and she got secondary burns all over her body. She had to stop shooting for weeks while she was...
Yeah, the makeup caught on fire.
Yeah.
The makeup itself caught on
yeah.
fire.
Yeah, not a safe place to be an actor. And you can only imagine what it was like for them in those costumes, considering because it was Technicolor, apparently the set, the lights had to be super mm-hmm. bright, and the set was over 100 degrees every day.
Burt Lahr in the lion costume,
oh my God.
Pounds every day from sweating.
I'm sure that must have been miserable.
They had to dry the thing out every night, and apparently it started stinking really badly.
I can only imagine. It must have been miserable.
Well, Bolger is the Scarecrow, the most beloved character for Dorothy. She mm-hmm. seems to like him the best.
Well, there's a story behind that. There's like, I remember you mentioned this before we saw the movie, that it always bothered you when she's saying goodbye to all the characters, that as she's saying goodbye to Scarecrow, she says, oh, I think I'll miss you most of all.
I would have missed the lion most of all.
I know the lion's your favorite. He is the best one. That's true. Although his makeup's totally creepy. Another thing I remember when I was a kid watching that movie is always finding the lion's makeup super duper creepy. So as she's leaving, she says, I'll miss you most of all. And it never really necessarily makes sense why she likes the Scarecrow best. But apparently there was a scene cut out from the end of the movie that implies that there was a budding romance between her and the Kansas version of Scarecrow, Ray Bolger's character, Hunk, back on the farm. So the implication is that there was already this romance budding, and that's why she would miss him most of all, because, you know, her subconscious loves him better than the other farmhands.
That reminds me of another thing about this film that was unique. Using the doppelgangers
mm-hmm.
for the many characters, Miss Gulch being the Wicked Witch, and the three farmhands being her three friends, and Marvel being many people, but especially the Wizard of Oz. Mm-hmm. That was a unique thing. The book, of course, couldn't do that because there were you couldn't see people's faces.
I don't think that the farm story, like, she doesn't wake up from a dream in the book. That it was all a dream is an invention of the movie that was never done in the book.
That's also one thing that, although it absolutely works in this film, what a cop-out that's been in so many movies.
Yeah,
I mean, bad legacy from Wizard of Oz, maybe.
It's amazing to think that this movie is considered one of the greatest movies of all time. It was all a dream. But it does work in this movie.
I guess the one thing that excuses it is that it clearly isn't real, because yeah. when she is knocked out and the house is going crazy and somehow gets pulled off of its foundation and the house itself doesn't just fall to pieces is pretty dubious. I mean, Uncle Henry needs to talk to his contractor, because how could his house be built in such a way that a tornado could just pick the whole thing up? Although I suppose it actually stays together when it is picked up. But yeah, when she's knocked out and she's in the house and everything, it's clearly not based on anything real. Yes, Toto. Also known as Fox.
Oh, that just reminds me of one more thing. So while Toto gets credit, like they credit the dog in the movie, you know who doesn't get credited in the movie? Are any of the Munchkins. None of them have names. They're just...
The singer Munchkins or something.
Yeah, like that, they just get credited for the troupe that some of them belong to, not all of them. But none of their names end up in the credits.
Well, Toto had more of a screen presence. Terry.
Listening.
Good old Terry.
Yeah, but Toto doesn't care if he gets screen credit or not.
Toto was also injured in this movie. Terry was also injured.
Oh, no.
Yeah, somebody stepped on her. I think it was a her. And she was out for a little while, too.
No.
Walking Wounded kind of movie. And I've said this many times before. We talked about this with whichever movie it was, I forget now, where a troubled production and somehow the movie worked. And I said to you what I've been saying to people for years. They'll say, a troubled production will never make a good film. And yet some of the great films have worked out.
Yeah, I've been surprised.
Beyond that, I told you the list before. Titanic, Apocalypse Now, Jaws, Gone with the Wind had troubles. And certainly this one did too.
Yeah, big time.
And let's get into some of those production issues. I don't know if there's so much, well, there's sort of troubles because they recast the director. Here are the list of people that directed this movie. Most of these names will mean nothing to our listeners. They mean not that much to me, but here they are. Richard Thorpe, George Cukor, who also directed AFI's The Philadelphia Story and My Fair Lady. So there you go. There's a pretty big name. King Vidor, who did many films, mostly of the silent era. And finally, Victor Fleming, who also directed another checkered MGM production, Gone with the Wind, which will be two films from now. Mm-hmm. Fleming was not the last one, but the one who did the bulk of the film. Cukor didn't really direct anything. He mostly advised. Thorpe started the production. They didn't like what he was doing. I don't think they used any of his footage in the film. And Vidor apparently did the Kansas sequences. Maybe not all of them, but he did the bulk of those. They also had a screenplay by committee with Noel Langley, Florence Ryerson, and Edgar Allan Wolfe, big names in the writing community, getting primary credit amongst, I don't know, a dozen names?
Yeah.
Other notables were Ogden Nash and Herman Mankiewicz, who, of course, co-wrote Citizen Kane with Orson Welles.
And I think there's some dispute with them kind of bickering about who deserved credit for how much. It's just a mess.
Yeah. But somehow managed to make it work. And they're basing on a book. Maybe that helped. They already had the structure in place. Back to Fleming for a second. Now, he started in the silent era. And after Wizard of Oz and Gone with the Wind, he only made about a half dozen more films. He also directed Captain's Courageous with Spencer Tracy and the 1941 version of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, also with Tracy. And even though Fleming is no one's idea of a legendary filmmaker, no other director has two films in the top 10 of either the 98 or 2007 top 100.
There you go.
Despite Spielberg and Coppola and Scorsese and Wells all having films in there, Hitchcock. Hitchcock's, I think, the closest to having two top 10s in the second list. Psycho is something like 14th and Vertigo is in the top 10. And one more guy behind the camera who we certainly have to acknowledge is Mervyn LeRoy. He was the producer and he also directed some of the sequences. He directed other films before and I think after this one. And he is the guy they give producer credit to. Also, Arthur Freed, who became a pretty famous musical producer, was an associate on this one. He was just learning, I guess, at this point.
Well, one thing we obviously agreed upon early on is the music is just one of the best things about this movie.
Sure.
Every song, they're really, truly delightful.
Speaking of the music, I love the story that's been pretty famously told, although other people have denied it, that supposedly Pink Floyd's The Dark Side of the Moon album syncs up with moments from the movie. I don't know if it's true or not. I've never actually done that.
I have a friend who insists that it's eerie how good it is. But then I also remember when you and I watched Birth of a Nation, and the copy we watched, somebody had just kind of, maybe not randomly, but somebody had just added their own music, and it was famous classical scores from ballets and symphonies. And as we were watching it, it was incredible how much your brain just kind of blends it. Like, it seems like it was meant to be there. So I wonder if it's the same thing with this. That maybe it's a happy coincidence that it has a few really great points that it hits perfectly. But I don't know. I haven't seen it. I shouldn't, you know, comment on it. But I have a friend who has watched it, Carl. And he insists that it's really quite good.
One more technical thing I want to note about the film. Is this the first color film on the Top 100 Project since Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs? And only the second one we've had so far, and they're also the two most famous movies we've reviewed.
That's true.
Apart from Gone with the Wind and Fantasia, both of which are pretty soon, this is the last color film we'll review until we hit the 1950s early in 2014.
Really?
I was surprised how many black and white films there are in the 40s. Huh. Almost entirely black and white films.
Yeah.
I knew there'd be mostly, didn't know it'd be entirely. And of course, we're still a long way away from widescreen and...
Oh, yeah, of course. And
a predominance of color. Maybe it's time for trivia question number two.
All right, hit me. Feeling confident from my half success of knowing Annie M's name.
You did know Gail. Not everyone knows Gail.
Yeah, I knew Gail. Yeah, I did.
So number two is, what three objects does the wizard give to Dorothy's friends?
He gives a diploma to the Scarecrow.
Correct.
He gives a heart-shaped clock to the Tin Man.
Yeah, fake toy heart.
Yeah. And he gives a medal to you the Cowardly Lion. I know things. You know what? I also remember when I was a kid. I really remember when I was a kid totally finding that so bogus and disappointing because I was so curious through the whole movie. How is the wizard going to help them? And then it's total BS.
He just gives them junk he's got laying around the house.
Are they that stupid? They're like, wow, it is kind of like having a heart because it tells time. Just like a heart. No! No, Tin Man! You murdered for that man.
He was only an accomplice. Dorothy's the one who threw water on her.
You committed an assassination for a clock? Stupid. My childhood analytical brain couldn't accept
it. Well, you said murdered for that, which we all know, of course, is the melting.
So yes.
Where the water is thrown the witch, and that is her undoing. No wonder the witch is so angry.
She can't take a bath.
She must never be able to take baths or showers. And who can be comfortable or content with dirty feet and unwashed hair?
Maybe her skin's actually normal color, but the green is just the accumulation of filth that she's been unable to wash.
When I get burned in a bad stunt that goes awry, I can't wash my face even then.
And I'm not the first person to point this out, but if I could be murdered by a splash of water, I would probably not keep a bucket of water near my sworn enemy. Just saying.
I guess that brings us to The Influence then. And talk about influence.
Oh, yeah.
This movie's right there with The Godfather and Casablanca as one of the most quotable movies ever made. We all know the great quotes. Two quotes from the film that didn't make the top 100 quotes list, and I thought certainly could have, and two of the best quotes in the movie that apply to maybe modern politics would be, "Some people without brains do an awful lot of talking." And the other one would be, "Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain."
Oh, yeah.
That one especially applies to so many great things in other movies and in our lives and whatever.
That line in particular is just one of those examples of the way this movie has been woven into the fabric of culture. I think people say that, they know what it means. I don't even know if you really think about the origin of it anymore. Mm-hmm. It's just become part of language.
But there's a literal man behind a literal curtain in this
film. Yeah, but he is representative of everybody whose power is false, whose power is only given because people believe it.
Now, other influences on the film. Well, actually, it was made already. A silent version was made in 1925.
I think there were two silent versions.
I did not know there were two.
Yeah, I think there was one in like 1910. I could be wrong about that, but I'm pretty sure there were two prior to this.
We talked about The Dark Side of the Moon sync job, deliberate or not. George Lucas clearly took elements for Star Wars. Chewie's the Cowardly Lion, C-3PO is the Tin Man, R2-D2 is Toto. The main character has an aunt and uncle rather than parents.
Oh, yeah.
And there are other things. I mean, I think he's even acknowledged his debt to Wizard of Oz. Wicked, the stage musical.
Oh, yeah.
Where the witch is the heroine. Oh, it was a book first.
Yeah, it was a book first, yeah.
And then Oz, the Great and Powerful, a mediocre prequel that came out earlier this year.
I think you're forgetting something really important.
Which would be?
Which is the Walter Murch classic, Return to Oz, starring Firouz Balk. Not only have I seen that, but for some reason, even though I never watched Wizard of Oz very much as a kid, we must have had a copy of Return to Oz or something. I watched it over and over and over when I was a kid, and I didn't really understand. Like, it was one of those movies for some reason. I also did this with Grease 2. I have no explanation for this. Those were two movies, Grease 2 and Return to Oz, that as kids, me and my sisters watched over and over without having any context of what the originals
were. You were out of your element.
We were out of our element, and I remember so much more about that movie.
Wow.
Yeah.
I've not seen either one of those sequels. There's also, let's not forget the Michael Jackson version. Well, he's the Scarecrow.
Oh, yeah, The Wiz,
The Wiz that Sidney Lumet directed in the late 70s, early 80s. Mm-hmm. One more thing I definitely want to comment on when it comes to influence, and there's probably 40 other things we could say, but one of the one I've always thought had to be deliberate, but somewhat subtle at the same time. I swear Nicholson is mugging like the Scarecrow in The Shining, especially in the scene where he chops down the bathroom door. If you remember the scene where the Scarecrow says, "What about Dorothy? Getting her home," or something like that. The look on his face, Nicholson has some of the same looks in his face in The Shining. I think if you were to watch The Shining and the movies back to back, you might notice that.
I'm going to have to pay attention to that next time I watch The Shining.
I have a feeling that if you ever asked Nicholson directly if he was doing Ray Bolger, he might say, "How did you know? Because the Top 100 Project told me so."
Yep.
Maybe I'm
You're
wrong
like,
about that.
Only Ryan Ellis caught on.
I could be stretching, but I just have always thought that. All right, now, I'm going to take a gigantic deep breath. I might even share some of these with Bev here. For the awards and other AFI lists, this is the biggest one so far. Over the Rainbow was the number one song on the Top 100 Songs list. Ding Dong, The Witch is Dead was 82nd. So it won the Oscar for Over the Rainbow as Best Song, and it won the Oscar for the Music Score. It made the National Film Registry in 1989.
The inaugural year.
Inaugural year of that list. And it had three quotes on the Top 100 Quotes list. I just mentioned two that should have made it. But anyway, the other three are, "I'll get you, my pretty, and your little dog, too," was 99th. "There's no place like home," was 23rd. And Toto, "I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore," cracked the top 10 by finishing 4th. Robin Williams loves that line. He's used it in so many places, his stand-up act and other movies. Okay, I'm tired. You take over.
The Wizard of Oz was 43rd on the Top 100 Thrills list. It was 26th on the Top 100 Cheers list. The Wicked Witch of the West was the 4th best villain on the Top 100 Heroes and Villains list. It was number 3 on the Top 25 Musicals list. And it was number one in the fantasy category of the top 100 genres list.
Epic.
Mm-hmm.
All right, it's time for our final trivia question, number three. Here we go. What city name is on the balloon at the end of the movie?
Oh, is it Kansas City?
It is not.
Oh.
Now, other people listening to the podcast may be jumping out of their skin saying the name of it, but I won't right now. And what we'll do is, as we did last week, we'll save it for the beginning of next week's podcast. And we'll also throw up, oh, two or three or maybe five or six other trivia questions from Wizard of Oz on the website you can answer at your leisure. And if you want to cheat, go ahead. You'll know that you're a bad person.
You'll know in your heart.
Meantime, that's all I have to say about the Wizard of Oz, but Bev has one more quote she wants to end with, and it's a legend in his own right.
Oh, yes, Roger Ebert. I wanted to finish on this. I mean, I like the movie a lot. I totally agree. It belongs on the list. It doesn't move me necessarily, but the value is so apparent, and I'm thrilled that people love it and that it has this place in film history. But I found this great quote from Roger Ebert, who wrote, "The Wizard of Oz has a wonderful surface of comedy and music, special effects and excitement, but we still watch it 6 decades later because its underlying story penetrates straight to the deepest insecurities of childhood, stirs them, and then reassures them."
Oh.
Well, we really couldn't say it better. I think that actually really wraps up what that universal appeal is of the film.
Agreed. All right, that's it for Wizard of Oz.
So before we wrap everything up, we have a new addition to the podcast that we're going to do today, which is listener mail. We started receiving some feedback from our listeners, so we want to incorporate that by addressing some criticism that we received regarding our Frankenstein podcast, where we debated what is and isn't a horror movie, and which movies would or wouldn't be considered horrors that are on the list. And I said I didn't consider Silence of the Lambs to be a horror movie, to which I got this comment: Silence of the Lambs is too a horror,
with many exclamation marks. Well, we had said that there were only 3 horror films on the list, the 3 being Frankenstein, Psycho, and The Sixth Sense. And The Sixth Sense didn't even make the first list, and Frankenstein didn't make the second list, so both of them had 2.
Mm-hmm.
Only.
Mm-hmm.
With other films being very debatably horror films, Jaws and Silence of the Lambs would be absolutely top of that list, but we didn't include them in such. This listener thinks that Silence of the Lambs should have been in there.
I always consider Silence of the Lambs a thriller.
A police film procedural. We looked up on the IMDb those 5 titles, and this is interesting. Frankenstein is considered
a horror sci-fi.
A horror film, and all the films have more than one connotation in different things. Mystery for some of them, crime for Silence of the Lambs. Psycho's got horror as part of that. Frankenstein does too. Sixth Sense does not.
Yeah, that's so strange. It's about ghosts, for goodness sakes.
And Jaws does. Adventure, yeah. Horror, and thriller, I believe, is the 3rd one. And Silence of the Lambs does not.
It does not, which means I win. But I will concede this, that we looked up the definition of horror, which according to dictionary.com is a motion picture calculated to cause intense repugnance, fear, or dread. I think that you could consider Silence of the Lambs fits into that criteria. And that's it was true. Actually categorized as a horror movie for the first couple of years of its release, and it's only kind of since been considered more of a thriller. And this kind of like prompts a discussion about how horror is a genre that has more niches, has more sub-genres than most. Definitely. Genres.
And some of the best subtext that's ever been on a film screen.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So it actually is like really hard to peg whether a movie is a horror or not. Although, even if you include all these movies, they're still underrepresented on the top 100 lists.
Mm-hmm. So she's probably right, but we still dispute that it's truly a horror film. We've come full circle on this question. Yeah. Not really answered it at all.
Well, let us know what you think. Add your comments to the website. We'd love to hear what everyone thinks on this.
Well, hey, we could still go back to the same thing in the end, that The Exorcist could have made this list, and so could Rosemary's Baby, and so could Bride of Frankenstein, and so could many others.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so that's it for the Top 100 mailbag for this week. We'll probably do this again, probably soon. Next week, we've got Frank Capra's 2nd of 3 films on the Top 100 list. Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, starring our old friend Jeremy Stewart there.
Our first Jimmy Stewart
movie. Our first of 5 Jimmy Stewart movies.
Wow. This is another one that I've never seen. In the meantime, for more from Ryan and me, please visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes, or you can find us on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. You can also reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com, and follow us on Twitter, @Top100Project.
Glinda's the villain.
And cut.